Sorry to start a little bit late, but it feels almost like a, well, I guess it is a summer recess in some respects.
As I said to you, this is for a legislature.
Yes.
This is early start.
Right. So we compromised a little bit today and provided some opportunity for networking. We do have minutes to review and accept, assuming that everyone has had that opportunity. Thank you, Lundy. Second, please. All right. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, say aye. Thank you very much. Let me also take this opportunity to thank Jeannie Phillips. She does lots of work for this commission. She does this committee. She does a great job, and I didn't want her efforts to go unrecognized before I give up my term as interim chair. So, Jeannie, on behalf of everyone, certainly myself, thanks very much. We're going to start off with a presentation from Judy Ryman, as we promised, and she's going to give us an overview of other states' strategic plans. So, Judy, I know you've got a commitment beyond this one that you need to get to, so we're going to start off with Judy today. Thank you very much.
Judy, thank you so much. I think it might be helpful to clarify that in terms of the legislative intent of this commission, it really is, planning board, is really to envision it as a living, breathing document, and that it's really not about producing a report and then walking away from it. That we do need to look at it, assess it, do the measurements and see where we are in terms of goals. So this is not something you produce a 20-page document and said, okay, we're done. That's just, the document is the beginning. It's just the beginning. I want to welcome Senator Boucher.
Judy, thank you very much, and it's going to be very helpful moving forward to have the benefit of the work that you've done, and we'll certainly make sure that we incorporate some of the finer points of your research into our efforts moving forward. No other questions for Judy. We'll move into a discussion on the RFP process. And John, my understanding is that we're very close to issuing this RFP. Yes?
Does everyone know John Parker? Also legislative manager in his office. It's amazing in helping us.
I believe we are. I did receive from you, John, some additional comments that have to be incorporated. I think we'll probably follow up with you offline as to make sure we're inserting the information in the right spot. But we'll be able to get a hold of you tomorrow. So beyond that, I was just looking at the timeline. Obviously, we have some slippage. We had planned to issue on May 31st. I think if we can button up all the details, we'll probably have it out by the end of this week. So we're not too far behind, maybe 14, 15 days at this point.
Okay. I'm just looking at the last revised timeline. It said public proposal on June 21. So we're probably not too far off. Yes. Does that public proposal mean the issuance? Is that one and the same?
Yes, because then we'll have it out there, and then the next step would be we'll be entertaining questions. We gather all the questions, and we have to come back to the committee and present the questions and develop appropriate responses to them.
Okay.
So yeah, we're probably not too far off from where we wanted to be.
Great, thank you. So I appreciate all those that have responded to, have commented on the RFP, and we did make an effort to incorporate your comments, not necessarily verbatim, but at least within the spirit of your comments into the RFP. So let me open it up at this point. We'll say speak now or forever hold your peace, but this will be your last opportunity to provide input on this RFP. So we want to make sure that we do capture as best as we can your interest and sentiment. So let me open it up, Judith.
This is just a point of clarification, and I know we had a slight conversation about this. I don't even think it was a conversation, but it was alluded to. There's a lot of talk in here about K-12, and I'm wondering, since we know that the achievement gap actually starts at 9 months of age, why we're not looking at younger children?
First of all, we are, and we will have a new person joining our board, Sid Oppenheimer, who is with Connecticut Voices for Children. So I'm very excited about that. We do have Mr. Moore, who is assistant superintendent in West Hartford. So, you know, hopefully we are going to be cognizant of all that and try to see, you know, that we're thinking pre-K through 20, not just looking at it in a vacuum. So I think the addition of those folks to this group sends that message, I think, to all of us that they definitely need to be at the table. One of the issues that John and I talked about, and I think some of the other folks when we were doing the RFP, is, and the statute is really ensuring that we also, while we consider it, that we narrow our focus or our scope, that when looking at the other states' plans, I noticed that. Well, and I also heard feedback that the ones that were most successful were the ones that did hone in on that. Certainly there are a commission, pre-K through 20 council, hopefully, or based on what you're saying, we can involve them in the process. But the groups that we're looking at that would be doing this kind of consulting work are really specialized in higher ed.
And legislatively, that is the focus of
right.
this, in spite of the importance of that.
You mentioned, we like to call it lower ed, higher, but K through 12. So let's make sure we continue to have that, because there are certainly some gaps that I've been talking to some members of this group about, some of the challenges I think we have going forward in higher education that, as you said, start way earlier.
Yeah, I think if we had an office for early childhood and there were a system there, I would feel more comfortable about leaving it out, but that's questionable.
John, back in May, I sent you a page with several comments. Was that shared, and will it be reflected at all in the final draft?
Excuse me. There wasn't an attempt to capture anyone's comments verbatim, but we did have quite a lengthy discussion a few weeks ago with staff in regards to incorporating your comments and others. So I'd like to think they were captured, again, not verbatim, but if you feel as if they have not been, then let's talk about it.
Well, they are not reflected in the final copy we received this past week, and I can just take 2 minutes or
go
a minute.
Ahead.
To express my concerns, I think there's a broader concern of what we expect from the successful respondent, but I'm not going to deal with that now. I am going to say a few things about what I consider omissions from the RFP, and that concerns me very much. For example, there isn't anything that underscores the issue of community colleges. I know community colleges are mentioned in paragraph B13C, but there is nothing regarding community colleges under recommendations for policy. And given the discussion, nationwide discussion that's going on now with regard to community colleges, I think we can actually pioneer something in that area. There is also not particular emphasis given to non-traditional students, and by that I don't mean just adults. I mean everyone who is not a full-time student is a non-traditional student. And given that about 50% of the college population at the moment is composed of non-traditional students, I think our work should address the challenging issues regarding the completion of degrees by non-traditional students. There are particularly issues of finance, cash flow, and so on that we're familiar with. That's the second point. Also, since we're making an effort to tie the yield of higher education to the economic development of the state, I think it's important that we look at the post-BS, post-BA landscape, the issue of master's degrees and PhDs. And that is a challenging landscape. There are large corporations with large research and development operations. Clearly, they would prefer master's degrees. PhD degrees, we don't have that many universities that yield PhDs. And, for example, if you consider Yale, UConn, of course, does. Yale, those PhD students at Yale are not going to stay in the state. They're going to go somewhere else, and they come from somewhere else. UConn is a little different, and perhaps John Bennett can address that, but I think I get those demands from corporate heads about educated master's degree level scientists and engineers, and I don't think we've addressed that much, or perhaps not at all. A couple more points, and I'm done. We mentioned outcomes assessment. Judy before mentioned outcomes assessment and metrics. How do we measure that whatever plan we're going to put in effect actually provides and yields what we hope it's going to yield? We have to develop metrics, and I think the successful respondent has to take a part in creating engineering metrics, and perhaps every 5 years an outcomes assessment report should be submitted to the state governmental bodies as well as higher education. We really need outcomes assessment, otherwise we're just flying blind. And last but not least is the question of, and Julie Greiman kind of implied that, the question of sustainability. How do we sustain? Suppose we put in place a successful plan, how do we sustain it? What conditions will be in place to sustain and keep it as a living, breathing plan, and so that it doesn't fall by the way? Sustainability of the plan, I think, is important and should be addressed. So let me stop here. There are others, but I think it's probably the main points I wanted to make.
I'd just like to echo what Judith said. I sat on the CETA 20 Council, and we fought the consultant tooth and nail about the importance of they were originally not going to be a CETA 20 Council. It was renamed, reinvented, because the issue of school readiness is so important. And I don't think we have metrics for those children who come to school not ready to learn, then failing right up the line. But everybody acknowledges that it is so. And so I think we ought to at least acknowledge it in some way.
So when you say that, are you thinking about a reference to the importance of that, or...
Well, from what was just said, I don't know whether we can certainly we can't change the language of the underlying legislation, but in some way I think we ought to acknowledge the importance of ready to learn, not just when you're not ready in 11th grade, but that you were never ready in kindergarten. So the system... the failures of the system don't begin in middle and high school. You know, they...
Yeah, Chris, please.
I think that, it's a critical issue, the issue of readiness. I think that we are taking a risk here, though, by seeking to include it because we do know that the pre-K-12 experience and how these students are approaching higher education is cannibalizing the resources of higher ed through the remediation function. And I would hope that we would not replicate that process by cannibalizing our own limited budget here by trying to do too much, and that we have adopted legislation in this state and committed hundreds of millions of dollars just over the last couple of years towards a pre-K-12 revamp and a recognition of the importance of childhood education, which is clearly a vital investment by the state. Recognition of its importance, I think it may be outside the scope. I think something that's very much inside the scope is the alignment between what's going on pre-K-12 and higher ed, because currently that alignment is more rhetorical than real, and that some form, some consideration in this study should include how we can improve the alignment between the efforts being made in early childhood, pre-K-12, and higher ed. And I think in that way we can accomplish the connection of our resources rather than the diminishment of them. And then I'd like to suggest one subject which is omitted, and I apologize for not sending this to you in advance, John. In the B11 objectives and goals, the first line of the second paragraph, this strategic master plan shall include an analysis of demographic, workforce, and education trends. And although I suppose this could be a subset of education trends, we haven't referred to the enormous role of disruptive technologies in the society and in higher ed, and that I think we do need to call out the subject of disruptive technologies. To trivialize it, I would describe it as the MOOC phenomenon, but of course it's far more profound than that. The very nature of what is knowledge, what is teaching, how is it gathered, stored, disseminated, all of those kinds of issues speak to, for example, over the next two decades in this state, we will be in public and private sector, we will be expending in the billions of dollars on infrastructure for higher ed. How much of that money is going to be involved with technology, and how much of that's going to be involved with bricks and mortar? And then the academic requirements to prepare faculty and administrators to function in this new world driven by disruptive technology. So without not an exhaustive study here, but at the same level of awareness that we're looking at demographic data, we could also look at this role of technology actually potentially transforming significant elements of what a higher education institution is, what instruction is, what libraries are, all those kinds of questions I think we should at least identify in the charge to the consultant.
Did Chris's comments capture your interest sufficiently or not, the way he addressed the pre-K?
I would say not sufficiently.
No. Yeah.
Things come to mind in terms of the early childhood, and I agree with a lot of what Christopher had to say on, spreading ourselves too thin. But I think there's two aspects where higher ed fits into the early childhood. One is the training of teachers, and now with the changes in the requirements, I would hope that this committee would be looking at workforce shortage areas and how we meet those in higher education and ensuring that we have quality teachers for our youngest citizens. So that is very much, I think, part of our charge right now. think the issue of alignment, that is worth mentioning in here, although it has been in some legislation already here in Connecticut about the Common Core that's being adopted and aligning higher education with our K through 12. That really is a work in progress. And I don't know how we fit in that other than be cognizant that it's out there. And so I certainly have no objection to including it as something we would project for. Projections should include. Would it be there or recommendations for policy? Yeah.
I think there's some ways we can bring that in. Connecticut's just received a grant to look at the alignment between preschool and K through 3, and so there will be a work being done on that. And if there's some current work done that's funded privately through the Grassstein Memorial Fund, but there's a federal grant that now will begin to look more closely at that, and we can certainly look at the alignment between that system, those systems, and the higher ed system. And the other thing, you know, there was an allusion to preparing more people with master's degrees and PhDs. And as we need to have increased skills in the workforce, we're going to need increased academic credentials for those who are going to be teaching in the colleges. There's going to be a greater requirement to meet that. And we don't have enough, certainly in the early childhood field and in some of the other fields, there just aren't enough faculty that have the appropriate degrees. So we do need to look at that as well.
Let me just get back to those comments before we lose those thoughts. No, you're right. I don't see that reference to community colleges that you expressed. So let's try to So it's under numerical goals, but I suspect you were looking for it to be referenced maybe under recommendations for policy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Very good. And also, probably the same thing then you could say about the post-BA landscape, that you're looking for under recommendations for policy as opposed to numerical. Okay, I get it. Also, under the non-traditional students, I did see that referenced in B14E regarding the needs of minority and non-traditional students. I don't know if you're looking for anything beyond that or not.
There are issues with non-traditional students, and the more severe issues, in fact, are financial. And if there are going to be recommendations, policy changes or recommendations for policy change, I think that issue of the financial ability of non-traditional students to continue their studies, it's coming up again and again and again.
Yeah.
And individual schools have different policies, both private and public. There has to be some coordination.
Yeah, B14E does go on to talk about addressing the affordability of tuition in higher education institutions, the issue of student debts. I mean, to me, I would assume that that captures both the needs of traditional and non-traditional students. So, but some of the points you did make, I don't see captured in here. We'll try to get them in there. So we'll get this worked out. Yes, Lending.
I think the other part of the non-traditional student that's so important as metrics are the issue here is the extended period of time it takes for them to complete. And if a measure of failure is the failure to complete within the prescribed 2 years of the community college, that impact also has to be looked at in terms of the goal. It's not just about debt. It really is about the ability to...
I can just give a trivial example to underscore what I mean. A typical non-traditional student may be taking two courses in the spring semester, let's say. The semester ends at the end of May, and the summer semester begins almost a week later. and the student needs one or two courses in the summer to complete the degree or to come closer to completion. It's a question of cash flow, believe it or not. It sounds trivial, but that student has to find the money to pay up front for the summer courses. And there is no uniform policy among publics or privates how to deal with that. So quite often it will come to the level of a dean, let's say, where the student will ask, how do I deal with this? I need this course because my employer wants me to take this course. You know what I'm saying? It's just a trivial example, but it's very typical of the difficulties that the non-traditional students find themselves in.
For those of you that don't know, the copy with a bunch of scribbling in it that Jeannie or somebody provided for the group are the comments that I shared, and I apologize when I sent it, but I did only send it this morning, so I'm quite sure that they haven't really been considered by anybody in terms of the process. And I'll allow you to read, expect and know that you can read those on your own without my having to discuss them particularly with you. I think I can summarize the comments that I made in two different requests that I would like to see as part of the RFP, and that one is that I think there needs to be a better language of cooperation between the consultant and this committee. And I put a number of suggestions in here that I think address that issue. And so when you're looking at them, please remember that was one of my main concerns as I read it and studied it. The other thing that I think is very important is that there needs to be an understanding right up front among us on this committee working with the consultant and in any information we share with all the institutions, and I think we do need to. I think there needs to be an expectation that there is a broad conversation, discussion, and cooperation among the higher education institutions as well as the pre-K-12, not leaving them out any further, whenever it's appropriate. I don't mean to say that we need to manufacture places where that occurs, but when any of the institutions or when the committee looking at it or the legislature looks at it, I think they should expect that whatever they're reading or listening to in terms of a presentation ought to include the results of the institutions themselves, pre-K through 20, having discussed things among themselves where it's appropriate. And I'm not sure when I was on the faculty, I didn't see enough of that happening that I was aware of. And I'm not sure that there really is enough of that taking place. I honestly think, for example, that if there were even discussions among the pre-K-12 institutions or even the pre-K-3 groups or 5 groups, that a lot of the things that are already where there's a fair amount of funding available, I suspect that there are some things that these groups know are working better than what some of the other ones that might have been mandated or whatever. And so I think one of the discussions in a climate of financial where money certainly, if it ever was, it's certainly not just automatically available today. And I believe that there's probably some good cooperation that can take place that, frankly, isn't being explored because they see themselves as a series of silos being directed from above.
Let me also make this comment that, and so we're going to try to capture these comments in the final draft, and we've got to do that in short order to meet our timetable. So one other thing I would say is that my expectation is that committee members will be involved hopefully early on in the process with the consultant in some series of either interviews and or focus groups that will afford everyone an opportunity to embellish their thinking about the topics mentioned today, as and probably many others that you think of between now and then. So my expectation is that that's how this process will unfold. And it's certainly, I might expect that other issues that we haven't discussed today will surface during the course of our conversations that will be incorporated in this strategy. So I very much appreciate everyone's input today. It's terribly important to try to get these comments in the final draft. What else? Who else would like to comment? Yes.
Hi. I just wanted, the mine is more structural. One, you talk about the Higher Education Commission, but it was unclear to me whether that represented our group or the legislative body that you are part of. So if I was reading it as a consultant, I would assume that I was dealing with you all and not with this group. I don't know whether that has any bearing on how you write it, but that was one conclusion. The second one has more to do with the fact that my business is a consultant, not in the state or anything. I'm not trying for that. But usually when I do contracts, I get some money up front. I don't do work for 7 months before I get paid. And there's nothing in here, and it doesn't sound like that goes in that direction. Now, that may be standard state policy, but that's what I'm used to. And the third one I was going to bring up, and I don't know that needs to be incorporated, I assume if somebody's going to ask it, is we already had a presentation on some of the demographics and numbers and things like that. So there's what resources are available to the people that are doing this, because if I was writing a proposal for this, I would think I have to do all this work, and not knowing that my time and energy should be put more into the integration of all the different thinking rather than finding the statistics, because that in itself is very time consuming.
A couple of notes here. John, could you answer about the payment and the structure, how that works with the state? Because we discussed that.
Yes. The payment structure is somewhat up to our discretion. We typically like to have work performed before we pay out money. It has happened in the past where we do give money up front. I think we were looking to get the proposals from the vendors and make that part of the evaluation process. So if you have somebody, and there again, I think we're looking at the entire proposal and the value of it, but then beyond that, we are going to rate the payment schedule. It's not a major component, but it certainly will be factored in. And if you have a really, what you believe to be the best proposal and there is money is required up front, we could always negotiate that going forward.
Thank you very much for clarification. Then I am interpreting what you're saying, if I was the consultant asking you this question, is that give us your best proposal, and then you lay out the payment schedule you'd like to see. And if you agree with that and the proposal, otherwise you might negotiate that differently?
Yes, that's our typical practice.
Chris?
I just need to observe that I hope we can find a way to move past that practice, that the state can manage the cash flow of $150,000. The state has ample capacity to assure performance, and it is a significant detriment in terms of reducing the number of firms who can afford to do this kind of work. And so I think we are narrowing the pool of applicants, and I don't think payment schedule is necessarily something that should be evaluated if we in a competitive arena. If we believe that the firm may be unlikely or unable to perform, then there need to be other ways to find that than whether they need upfront money or get the money paid later. And I would observe that many of the state agencies do in fact make as much as 20%, 25% down payment upon execution of a contract.
It seems to me that we're going to look to try to find the best consultant. We'll pick that consultant and negotiate as appropriate with the payment schedules. Yes?
That is correct. I think the one thing we have to safeguard against is that we're not looking at a small firm that may not be here after we give them a payment. So we have to, being state funds, we do have to guard against that.
I do fully appreciate that. And if we were talking about a $100 million contract, I think we would certainly want to do that. We're talking about a large amount of work and a short turnaround for a small amount of money. There are other ways, including insurance, but there are other ways to assure performance. And I think that how much we negotiate introduces non-standard outcomes. And it becomes almost a subjective determination on payment. And our judgment should be used on the quality of the work and an overall assessment of their capacity to perform. I know this is not your personal policy. I don't mean to suggest that it is. I'm just saying, in general, our procurement at this level needs to be more efficient and less ultimately subjective. These are not – payment schedules shouldn't be negotiable at this amount of money.
One more comment, answer to, yes, Lois, I'm sorry, Lois is, my head cold is also affecting my ability to think. In terms of data that's out there, there is so much available right now on Connecticut from additional national organizations, and many of these consultants that will be bidding on this will already, I assume, be very familiar with the different, data that's out there. So they're not going to be necessarily creating or searching unless we ask them for something very specific. Thank you.
Thanks, John. One of the things that I noticed looking through this was one area I think we need to add on projections or recommendations for policy is something having to do with something that Connecticut actually does pretty well, which is online learning. I know there's a mention here about non-traditional students. I think it's a little broad for a state that has its own online institution, and also any of us who've heard President Herbst at UConn talk, I mean, one of her goals is to nearly triple, I believe, the number of online course offerings. And I imagine that just about every independent, non-public institution is also offering that type of learning as well. So I think we do that pretty well compared to other states, but I do think that's something that the consultant should be looking at in particular, especially as it's growing. To what extent does Connecticut want to have a handle on how that's growing?
I wanted to go back to the issue of the payment schedule. I have to respectfully agree with Chris. I think we ought to be able to create, based on the very specific timetable that's laid out here in the deliverables, that, many of the contracts I've worked with consultants is to tie payment to delivery of a satisfactory progress, and then to insert something in the contract that says, it's always possible if you're not delivering the quality that, we can change that. But I do think that it is a lot of work. This is, we've asked for a great deal of information in this, and not to provide any money, you know, or to have to negotiate. That means we might lose out on somebody that's, you know, and granted, they're not going to be little individual people, but it's life is tough in that. I mean, or they may take another assignment in that place. So I would encourage us to try to work that through.
I trust that we're not going to lose the best consultant based on having over payment specialists. So. But fair point. Point well taken. Any other comments on the RFP? if not, yes.
Well, I have a question. I think nobody in this room can answer it, really. Namely, the possibility we're going to find a successful respondent that can do all the things this RFP specifies. Because there is work to be done at the governmental level. Governmental bodies clearly are involved. And work to be done with private and public institutions from their high administration to the issue of curricula and so on. And I'm just wondering whether we're going to be able to find someone who can do those things. They are so distinct and so separate, and yet they have to come together if the plan is going to be successful. As I said, I don't expect an answer. I'm just expressing my concern.
Well, I don't have an answer other than to say that
we hope for the best.
We hope for the best and expect we'll find someone that will take on the challenge that we're going to present then. So, yes.
Senator Boucher.
Thank you very much, and I apologize if I wasn't here earlier. There's quite a storm out there, by the way. Anybody leaving the building, hopefully it'll be over by the time you get there. Just a question on the actual RFP. There were two places where I noticed that it said eliminate the post-secondary achievement gap between minority students and general population. That's in numerical goals E. And also in the section under objectives and goals B1.1 on the second page where it is in addition stakeholders to reach appropriate recommendations to enable hire to meet projected workforce, in part by eliminating the post-secondary achievement gap between minority students and general population. I would recommend eliminating the word eliminating and put reducing, only because I just don't see how that is achievable ever to eliminate entirely those areas, if you see what I'm saying.
No, exactly. As a matter of fact, we had this, I raised that same issue. I said eliminate seemed to be very ambitious, unrealistic. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it went back to the language of the legislation.
It's the bill.
It's the bill, and that's why I was incorporating. Okay. Otherwise, I would have...
We could set a high bar for ourselves.
Yeah. So, it's a point well taken, and I made the same comment.
And also, I noticed quite a bit on funding was replete throughout this. And in the first other objectives and goals, there was a lot in the first paragraph on research and the second paragraph analysis of trends and then completion and funding policies, economic growth, and then branding, including a branding approach to effectively communicate this and objective. Okay, and that was originally intended as well.
Branding, I don't remember the branding.
That,
I think the branding
in the
was an
RFP.
Add-on.
It was. Okay.
Yes, it was. That was
okay.
Pretty sure.
Right. It just raised the question in my mind.
I think it was added, that was a part of the discussion I may have had with the Board of Regents, the importance of trying to, with our 17 institutions, you know, UConn's done a very good job with branding and getting out there. Our 17 state colleges and universities haven't really done a good job, as good a job as marketing themselves. And as you know, we've been concerned on the Higher Education Committee about proprietary schools taking low-income kids and taking their money and getting them in promises when they could have gone to a community college. So it is an issue of concern. I hope that is something we take a look at here.
And the final question I might have, is there anything in here that talks about for-profit institutions in the landscape of what is happening in Connecticut? There seemed to be a flurry of them during this last legislative session. Should that not be a consideration of this at all, and how they are even considered or used in the land? Is it?
We're good.
One last thought. I noticed that in Maryland's plans there was a heavy emphasis on economic growth and vitality, and I think I did see it here somewhere. But I was looking at our goals that were in the PowerPoint. They were just four of them, and I was thinking that they're not in the PowerPoint. Okay. Heavily on economic development too. Very good. Thanks. By the way, does anyone know, Chris Brule might know, what is our current unemployment rate in Connecticut? What is published? Pardon? 8%. Thank you.
No. Okay. I'm going to turn this over.
The real number.
There are a variety of ways to measure unemployment. There is, if you want to include a more inclusive measure, it would be higher. But the official unemployment rate for the state is 8.0.
Appreciate the time everyone took to review this document and make comments on it. Hearing no other comments, we'll move on to the issue of identifying a permanent chair, and I'm going to turn this over to Representative Willis.
First, I have to say thank you to John for stepping up to the plate and really getting us going, and all the work that he has done. I know that most of you haven't seen that, but it has been daily communications, working on the RFP, organizing, you know, our upcoming meetings, who's going to speak. John has been great and generous with his time, and I really appreciate that. But as you all know, he said not past June. And it's June. I don't know how we got here so quickly, but we did. So with that in mind, it says election, and obviously we didn't have a flurry of candidates come forward, but we were able to find someone who we think would be absolutely fabulous, and very excited that she has agreed to serve as our chairman, and that is Judy Resnick. And I am pleased. Thank you, Judy, for stepping up to the plate. I think this is a perfect fit for us. She has the economic and business connection, and then at the same time, she has the education foundation. So it is something that she's been involved in for a long time, and I've admired her energy and her commitment, and that's what we need, is someone who is not going to just get us through the strategic master plan, but someone who's going to get us over the finish line with implementation. And I think she has the skills and the juice to make that happen. So anyway, thank you, Judy. I don't know if you want to say anything. John is very grateful that you did this, and we sort of got close. He said he would serve through our July meeting, and so we could have a little transition period. But I think we're very fortunate to have somebody who is willing to take this on. It's, you know, it's going to be a heavy lift. It's a big commitment. And
Let me just thank you for your confidence, although it's quite unnerving. the deal for all of you is that we do need to do this together. This is not something that could be done by, but with. So with your help and Roberta's support and John's fine start, I look forward to working with you and learning with you.
thanks very much, Judy, for stepping up to take on the chairmanship. And frankly, I've enjoyed the last few months of working with all of you and the staff and our senators and representatives. We've got a lot of dedicated folks here, and it's fun to work with all of you and all of them to move this very important process forward. So I would entertain your thoughts on a topic or speaker for the July meeting. We said that we've got, I won't call it downtime until the consultant comes on board, but for lack of a better way of saying it, we have a little bit of downtime, so to speak, to maybe further inform all of us about what we're stepping into here. So if any of you have any thoughts about... Yes, Lindy.
I'm thinking that, well, two things. It might be very interesting to hear where we are with the middle colleges or whatever iteration they're called now, so that we don't... I always believe in doing an inventory of assets before we go forward, and I know there's a lot of work being done, particularly around the legislation that allows that disallows community colleges to continue this lengthy road of remediation. So they're embedding in high schools, and it'd be great to hear some metrics and about that program.
I don't know if you've done this yet, but it would be great to have another state's description of their going through the same process and the trials and tribulations, what's worked, what hasn't worked, that have been all the way through having the consultant, completing that process, and then implementing a plan. If it's possible to reach someone in a state that would be close by or would be willing to share.
I'd like to pick up on the observation about distance learning and suggest that perhaps Ed Klonoski could be invited to talk to us about the distance learning consortium, but also to talk about some of the implications of as distance learning becomes a global phenomenon, and that I think that it's very consistent with the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about, and I think he's probably one of the most articulate and plugged-in spokespeople within the state. There are many, but I think Ed comes to mind immediately.
May I ask, Chris, if you mean that there is a trend now through some institutes of higher learning to have a cellular professor teach a course online that goes global and oftentimes is free of charge, and that has ignited quite a controversy among the professionals in higher ed, the professors, and so on, because they feel a certain threat with regards to some of that, and yet others are extolling the virtues of that and the ability to open the world of education to so many from throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the sort of thing that you're thinking?
Yes, I think there was controversy when calculators became affordable, and we began to say, how will kids ever learn to add and subtract if we have calculators? Now you're required to buy them to have them as a tool. So that this, you know, the online learning evolution into MOOCs and other things, it's at the calculator fear stage. It's going to be transformative. We need to understand it. No one can tell you what it's going to be, but it does certainly include faculty, current faculty online, others being brought in. But it's my understanding as a layperson, just from a few opportunities I've heard to hear about it, it's far more fundamental than that. And I think that with Charter Oak State College being the distance learning consortium manager in the state, they have committed some intellectual resource to try to be trend aware. And I think that might be helpful to us.
Well, it goes beyond, because Ed is also now head of a national consortium that's trying to do interstate agreements, and so it is a huge one. And UConn is talking online courses. Obviously, Charter Oak is online, and then we have some of our proprietary schools who are getting in the online business. So there's good news in it, and there's some concerns too. I have some serious concerns about it. Not from what Ed's doing, but some of the other people are getting into it.
There's no question about it, and the, it's that's why it's so important to consider it, because it is completely inevitable. The only question is what it will look like and what it will do to us and what we will use it for. But there's no holding it back. Idea that libraries had to be print, right? That students, you know, that they had to handwrite rather than type. This is simply a technology that has arrived. It will be destructive, and will that allow for more constructive use, or will it be hurt quality? So that's why I think we need to understand it, because precisely right, there are risks associated with it, but it's inevitable.
I'm so glad that you actually did that, brought it up, because I did take one of my last master's courses at UConn. Actually was the only online course I ever took in my life. It was dramatically different, and the kind of oversight on how much time you spent on it. But I often thought, well, someone else could be doing this and not me, for me, unless we had a camera there to see that I was actually inputting. But the time involved was more than I ever thought possible. The issue might arise on conferring degrees and credentialing at that point, the kind of ability to verify, you know, that the person is who they are and actually doing the work that they do, and if they and how they can overcome that. So it would make for a really fascinating debate or discussion. I'd love to hear that for sure.
So it looks like we've got more topic than meetings right now, which is good. So we'll try to figure out what we can put together for the July meeting, and you know, maybe there's a couple more meetings where we could do this. We have the opportunity to manage that in July and August before the announcement in September, I guess. So that's the goal, and we've got three topics for the next meeting too. And assuming no further business.
Oh, next meeting.
No, I'm sorry. Next meeting. We'll rely on Judy. What would be the next?
Oh yes, Judy.
Well, yes, the calendar. Yes, right. Would be July 9. Is that correct?
So all we need is Judy. So does that work for you? Okay.
No. July 9. Okay, well, yes.
Could I just ask that when the meetings are scheduled, they go out as a calendar invite, so it gets on your calendar as opposed to just an email?
Is that okay? Calendar invite?
As long as everybody has together.
Okay. All right, well, let's attempt to do that.
Do you need on the state website?
No, we do it on the invite.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Never mind. Ignore me.
All right, so we meet another month. Thanks, Travis.
Thank you.
Yes,
what?
Yes, I'm coming back.